Well, thank you for that introduction, Daniel. Daniel, by the way, has been a very gracious host. I've been toured around and been on down to see the Sonoran Desert, which was an excellent introduction to Arizona. And it's a particular honor today to be speaking in a forestry department, because it's been my impression that for too long, plant ecology and forestry have been like two separate threads rather than what is obviously one unified discipline. And I'm surprised still when I go to places, if I speak in the biology department, often there's very few foresters present. And if I in this case, I'm speaking in the forestry department, which is a really nice experience. But I'm pleased that we've had some biologists join us as well. And we can hope that perhaps in the coming decades, we can put these disciplines back together as a unified whole. It's also really nice to see a different ecosystem from the one I'm accustomed to working in. Certainly in coastal Louisiana, I'm focused very much on wetlands. But I think there's a lot to be learned by looking at a system that's very different from one's own. So I feel very challenged to be in a system where the shortage of water is the big story. And I've quite enjoyed driving through what Daniel tells me is the largest piece of ponderosa pine forest in the world, which is an awfully nice label to be able to put on your town or region. I gather, too, that I'm being recorded for an online version, so I should say hello to any of you who may be joining us later via the internet. And I've taken the liberty of putting a picture of myself for those of you who are signing on online. And there I am in my Louisiana guise, running the motorboat that goes to the field station, much to the horror of my assistants, who I can assure you normally drive the boat. But I am officially certified, and I do have the piece of paper to prove it. So today, what I would like to do is make a few introductory comments, maybe about why we do what we do as ecologists and what some of our driving goals might be. For at least maybe 5 minutes, talk to you about the work I've been specifically doing in Louisiana, although that's not going to be a big part of my work, of my presentation today. So this isn't one of those talks where I'm coming in and trying to impress you about all the stuff I've done. Maybe I've sat through too many of those talks in my life. And what I'd really like to stick to is a theme, which is how we go about using ecological models in the broadest sense to make sure that we're doing efficient and effective restoration. And then I'll describe two approaches using the general framework of pools and filters. I probably will take the full 50 minutes if any of you are keeping your eye on the watch. I don't get out quite as much as I should. Some of you know I've been ill for many years, and so I have to really pace myself. So when I get out, I like to make sure that I cover a topic that I want to cover. So if it seems I'm keeping track of the time, and if I, push towards the end, it's not that I was too lazy to plan my talk. It's that I have certain things I'd like to tell you while you have me here. Make the trip worthwhile and all that good stuff. So in many of the talks I've been giving lately, and particularly in Louisiana, I've been starting with this figure from E.O. Wilson's book, which is probably familiar to most of you. It shows biological diversity and how it's changed through evolutionary time. And you will notice that overall, the oh, I've started off already messing up the slides. Now, that's not bad when I'm only on the third slide. Okay. That overall biological diversity increases with time, but there are these occasional downward spikes indicated by these lightning bolts here, where biological diversity has dropped precipitously. And we are now in the one I've marked here in red, which seems to be the first one on Earth which is being driven by our own species. So depending upon whose figures you use, we can say roughly that a quarter of the Earth's biota is at risk of extinction. And so if there is one issue that, say, my generation and the next generation really needs to focus on, in my opinion, it's how we at least minimize the collapse in biodiversity that's facing us. And that's where something like the enormous program you have for restoring ponderosa pine forests seems to me to be such a positive initiative. And that if we followed this in each part of the world, we might well be able to protect a significant proportion of the Earth's diversity. So as you all know, this figure here is being driven by two drivers, and I'm not going to spend a good chunk of my talk on this. I've been told it makes people unhappy and uncomfortable. But we nonetheless need to remind you the two drivers are exponential growth of human populations and greed, materialism, the desire to own two Humvees parked in a driveway in a six-bedroom monster home with four bathrooms like I see being built in Phoenix and also outside New Orleans. It's a remarkable nationwide phenomenon, this need for enormous consumption. And consequently, although it's easy for us to blame developing countries for their enormous population growth rates, the environmental impact we're having per capita is extremely high. And so we all need to have in the back of our mind that ultimately we are going to have to deal with those two drivers. But in the meantime, we can be thinking about how we can protect the biological diversity of the Earth and develop restoration programs like you have here and try to develop tools and models which can be moved from one ecological region and from one ecosystem to another. So although I'm conscious that now I'm down in Arizona in the 21-22 region on the map, it was only a couple of days ago I was in region 53, which oddly enough is another pine-dominated ecosystem, longleaf pine. And if I drive just a few miles down the road, I'm actually in region 42, which is the Mississippi River floodplain. And it sometimes seems to me that in each of these areas, people are working at restoration and trying to invent the models and the tools from scratch. Almost as if we're going to have to develop 80-some fields of ecology when there's really only one. So one of the issues that I think we can really focus on is to what extent has some of this work already been done so that we can just pull it off the shelf and immediately apply it to our own part of the world. So I'm always trying to tell my students in Louisiana, read papers outside of Louisiana. And I don't know if you have the same issue here in Arizona, but it's often very hard to get people to look beyond their own state boundaries when they're learning their science. So maybe this is something we all have to work on a little. But the work I want to talk about today is work that I think could be applied to any one of these regions. Since people do like to know all the same what I've been working on the last few years, I just want to take a few minutes to walk you through a couple of the ongoing projects I have in Louisiana. I have been working in longleaf pine forests, and as I drive around the ponderosa pine system, I'm struck by these similarities. So we're looking at factors that control plant diversity in the understory, which I gather is a big theme here. And this is one of my graduate students who is working in a unrestored area, as you can see. But if this area is burned, it turns into a nice open pine forest, not unlike the ones I've seen. So some of this work on diversity in the understory is just starting to come out. On campus, we have a nice pond, and I've had a long-term experiment on plant competition going in this pond. You can see the lanes going from the water up on the shore, and we fluctuate the water in this pond. And I have species growing in monoculture in these lanes, and other lanes where they're growing in different controlled mixtures. So this is very much focused on competition. And Daniel mentioned my book on that topic. There's a couple of key questions that I don't think we have yet answered in competition. So this experiment was designed to answer those questions. An interesting reminder for those of you thinking about such work, this was a long-term project, and NSF has funded me for 5 years to do this. And what I have really been struck by is how impatient my colleagues are. What? You've been doing it for 2 years and you don't have anything published? I say, well, you know, the experiment was set up to run 5 years, then I'm going to analyze the data, so you're not going to see any papers for 7 years. And it's kind of like, well, why would you bother? So I mention that because I know that some of the issues you're dealing with here require long-term experiments. And I don't know how we can work at this, but to convince our colleagues that some pieces of work have to be done, even if they're not going to give you a publication next year, is a message that we still have to get out. This is closer to some of the work that you've been doing. We have a large restoration experiment set up in the marshes at Turtle Cove, and you can see here an enormous expanse of what used to be cypress forest. It was clear cut around the turn of the century and then bought by Mr. Schleeder, who eventually donated us his house, or his cabin. It's a three-story mansion as our field station, and this experiment is set out behind there, and we're manipulating fire, sedimentation, grazing, competition in a factorial way to explore how this affects composition in the marsh. Our plots are 3 by 3 meters, which we're kind of proud of, but when I see the scale of experiments going on here, it reminds me that we could push the boundaries a little more. And then, I don't know if there's anyone here who works on large predators, but I've been having a lot of fun as a botanist working with alligators and advancing the suggestion that a lot of benefits are provided, ecological benefits are provided by large alligators in particular, because as you know, our wetlands are being heavily grazed, particularly by an exotic species. And it turns out if you look at alligator stomach contents, that big alligators have lots of nutrients in their stomachs. So I've been suggesting that we need more large carnivores back in our landscape in order to protect the plants. And I think most of the ecologists in the room will see that as being fairly reasonable, but surprisingly, the people who study alligators are different from the people who study nutria, who are different from the people who study plants, and the idea that you might put all three together has also been surprisingly difficult to generate enthusiasm for. But if we have some people here studying large predators, didn't see any on Daniel. Do we have what's the big predator here? Mountain lions? Yeah. Okay, so, well, there's the mountain lion of the system I work in. And then the other activity I've been involved in is synthesis. And Daniel mentioned that I've worked on a few books while I've been in Louisiana. And the one that's going to come out really in a couple of weeks is Plants and Vegetation, which I hope will be used as a plant ecology textbook. And I very carefully tried to get examples from around the world to try to get a worldwide sort of view of what the basic concepts are in plant ecology, because so many of the textbooks seem to be quite regional. And since this is a forestry department, I can assure you I've even borrowed from forestry books and have some pictures of trees in there. So,
any soils information?
Oh, Yes, but it's odd you should ask that, because the soils I know the least about. And so it's the part I wrote out of a sincere desire to communicate. But I fear a specialist may have an issue or two with me. But yes, soils are in there. And the previous book, which actually took almost a decade, was The World's Largest Wetlands, which was a lot of fun. It meant collaborating with different teams from around the world. And there's a political story I'll share with you about this, since we're all academics and we're all trying to survive in academe right now. And I was surprised about my employer's reaction to the book on The World's Largest Wetlands, because I was quite proud of it. And as an endowed chair, I'm supposed to do some publicity and fundraising, so there's a picture of me in the paper with the book and so on. And somewhat later, I went through quite an intense, unhappy meeting with my administrators. And it seemed to me that they weren't at all happy with this book. And the long and the short of it seemed to be that writing books is not something that it's felt that scholars should be doing this day and age. It's more a Victorian type of pastime for gentlemen. And how do you evaluate a book? I mean, is it worth one paper? And if so, then I wasn't very productive in the time I was doing this. So it wasn't a happy meeting. And what dawned on me then, and I wonder to what extent it's becoming a pervasive problem for academics, is that when I look at that, I really look at something I'm proud of. It's a real scholarly product that has new material in it. And I realize that when my administrators look at it, all they see is the amount of time it took. And that was time I could have been out fundraising. And the pressure upon us now to bring in money to our universities rather than do scholarship, I have the impression it's gotten much more intense over my lifetime. And that's something we might want to discuss afterwards, and what impact that might have on the next generation of scholars. Because I'd like to think that some of our younger scholars would actually go out and have time to do field work and not just spend time chasing money, as important as that is. So yes, synthesis. The other reason that synthesis is important is that some of us are aging, and we have to remember that every one of us is eventually going to die. And what are we going to leave? One of the things it seems to me we have to do is communicate what we know to the next generation so they can efficiently pick up and take over our lifetime's work. And if we just leave a bunch of scattered papers, it's very difficult to do. So synthesis seems to me to be very important for the transmission of knowledge to the next generation. So that's what I've been busy at in Louisiana. And now to move on to the topic of the day. Oh, yes. There are distractions, of course. We take our partying very seriously. Our university president is a great believer in Mardi Gras, and the university actually closes for 2 days to allow us to fully enjoy the festivities. And down at the bottom right, you can see one of nice little hotel in the French Quarter, and that's surprisingly, doesn't it look like the Weatherford, where I'm staying here in Flagstaff. So this can be a distraction if you're not careful. So on to pools and filters. I want to describe to you an experiment that I did, which takes sort of a direct attempt to solve the pools and filters problem for one system experimentally. And just to go back to the bigger picture, when we're trying to do restoration, it seems to me that we could represent it as a figure like we have here on the left. We have a pool of species for the area. There are several thousand species of wetland plants along the Gulf Coast. Daniel says there's about roughly 3,700 species, thank you, Daniel, in Arizona. Now, all of these don't occur at any particular site. So somewhere at the bottom, we have a community, which is the actual set of species we find in a particular site. And you could say that what we're trying to do in ecology and forestry, restoration ecology, is figure out how to get from the top to the bottom. What are the filters that we have to put in to get the desired community? And I have a maze there because, by and large, I don't think we have it terribly well worked out right now. Although, you know, when I come here, I see, well, from this point of view, I hear that fire, say, is a major filter in this landscape. So anytime you're talking about setting up a desired community, fire regimes, frequency and intensity have to be considered. So one way that we could try to experimentally investigate this is to take a large number of species and subject them to a series of filters and see which filters are operating to keep them out of certain communities. And that's the basis of the experiment I'm going to share with you here, which was done at the Turtle Cove Experimental Marsh. There's the entry on the left, and at the top you can see that there is a large boardwalk coming down here into the marsh. And we have three 40 by 60 meter herbivore exclosures paired with areas without exclosures. And then there are catwalks with the yellow lines that you can walk out on to reach different experimental plots. And so we've been able to provide a randomized block with some split plots design to look at effects of fire, grazing, sediment, to simulate rivers flowing through and depositing sediment. Sadly, this experiment was absolutely smashed by Hurricane Katrina, and I don't know that we're going to be able to rescue it. I'm not going to show you the pictures of destruction, except to note that one of our treatment plots now has a large refrigerator sitting in it. So in this work, which is going to be coming out in Oikos later this year, we took a set of 16 plant species. So the idea was to take as big a group of plant species as we could and to try planting them into the wetlands out there, which are anthropogenic wetlands. They came into effect after clear cutting of the cypress swamps, and ask the question, why aren't there more native species in these anthropogenic wetlands? So can we provide different sets of treatments which will allow them to survive there? Now, ideally, you would want to, say, do this with something like 500 species. But it's very difficult to get that amount of material, and, you know, the experiment becomes inordinately large. So at least we use 16. There is the list of the species there on the left, woody species on the bottom. So we even have a red maple and cypress, and then herbaceous species, and I have four pictures of them here. I am not going to get the hang of this. Just not going to get it. So we have herbaceous species as well. And so for each of these, we transplanted them into these experimental wetlands with replication in plots with three major factors. So we could only manipulate three factors with this number of species. And we chose to manipulate grazing. So some of these were transplanted into exclosures and equally outside exclosures. We were able to manipulate competition. So some of them were transplanted into the existing vegetation. Some of them were transplanted into cleared plots. And then some of the plots had no sediment added, and some of them we added a centimeter thick layer of sediment, which presumably not only elevated the plots, but also brought in nutrients, because these areas used to be flooded by the Mississippi River. So we were able to manipulate three factors in factorial combination and say, is there some combination of these that would allow these species to reinvade the marsh? to show you what the overall effects were, I have first combined all the species. So just look at overall treatment effects on total dry biomass. So forget about the species names for the moment. Turns out that adding sediment, even though it was exhausting carrying those buckets of sediment out into the marsh and spreading them, had no measurable effect on any of the species. The main effects were competition and herbivory. So on the left, we have plots without grazing, and on the right, we have plots in the exclosures, so there is no grazing, and you can see the ungrazed plants were overall larger. And then the black and white histograms give you without neighbors or without competition, and the black is with neighbors. And inside the exclosures, you can certainly see there's a strong depressive effect of competition. So overall, without thinking about the species-specific effects, there's evidence that grazing and competition were the main factors involved in controlling at least the 16 species we were able to transplant. If you want to pull it out species by species, we can look at a table. And I wouldn't worry too much about the details of the table, particularly for those of you at the back. I think the main thing is to simply understand that on the left, we have species that responded to one of those treatments that was affected by at least one of the three filters. The first column is labeled herbivores. It says which species were affected by grazing. And it turns out that it was Taxodium, which is the cypress tree, and cattails. In fact, nutrias specifically seek out and destroy cattails. So quite interesting to me, because from the north I've seen enormous areas of cattail marsh, say around the Great Lakes, and I wonder, well, why aren't there more cattails around the field station? This may be one of the explanations. Cattails find them, and they nutria find them and eat them. The next column is labeled neighbors. And I don't know if anyone has sharp enough eyes, but there's a spelling mistake in this manuscript. After all the checking, neighbors is spelled wrong. So I apologize for that. There won't be any typos like that in the book, Daniel. I can assure you of that. Notice, though, that the dark numbers, that there were five species that were affected by neighbors negatively. So on a species-by-species effect, competition actually controlled more species than did grazing. So it depends what you think about the overall effect on all of the transplanted species or in a species-by-species effect. Finally, there were a couple where there were also interactions where herbivory and grazing together needed to be considered to tell the complete story. So overall, then, this experiment was an attempt to kind of leap directly from that pool to the community by looking at a number of specific filters and seeing if we manipulate those, can we change the resulting community? The two biggest weaknesses in that study were ones that are very hard to get around. One is still the lack of species. I mean, it was a lot of work getting 16 species in sufficient numbers to transplant into all those different treatments. But it still means that we can only talk about, at most, 16 species, and there's 1,000 in the pool. And, of course, the other is that this experiment did only run a year. And the growing season is awfully long in Louisiana, and things grow very fast, but all the same, you could argue that across many years, you might get a different series of effects. Of course, it's a lot more expensive to carry an experiment on that long, and you also run the risk that it will be destroyed by a hurricane. And in fact, this experiment got harvested when we were told a major hurricane was going to hit. And Ellen was out there frantically digging up her plants and bagging them and putting them in a cold room at the university just in case the whole thing was obliterated. So both of those are shortcomings, that time and number of species that we can always try to work on enlarging when we do a study. The next part of the talk, and really the closing part, is to take you quickly through six, or actually seven if you want to count it the other way, tools that you can use to manipulate diversity in restoration projects. And I'm going to go over these quite quickly. Sort of like you can imagine, I have a toolbox here, and I say, well, this is a screwdriver, this is what you do with it, this is a hammer, and this is what you do with it. And I've given some references in it, and Daniel mentioned my paper on six pragmatic models, so if you do want to look into any one of them more, you can. But at this point, let's just go quickly through the six and not worry too much if there's some subtleties which you miss. So again, there's that basic question about going from the pool to the community, and which is sort of the framework for this. And before we get into those six models, I should perhaps mention one other sort of issue of context, that if we look, I talked earlier about the division between foresters and plant ecologists, which I think is so unfortunate. We have another division in ecology between description and theory. And I've certainly been struck over the last 10 years by how much theoreticians seem to have grabbed a very strong hold in our discipline. And many of these theoreticians don't even have training in biology. They've made the jump from physics. And as a consequence, we have kind of a divide where a lot of people that I know that do the hands-on restoration work feel what the theoreticians are doing is of not much use. And theoreticians say, well, you know, you don't know much math, so what's the point of what you're doing? And how do we bridge that? Well, one way to bridge it is to realize that this is kind of an artificial dichotomy. In fact, Daniel and I were talking about models where you have actually drawings in them, you know, just different stand types, and what the forces are that convert you from one stand type to another. So I'd like to suggest that it's not quite so black and white, and that there's a whole set in between of what we might call pragmatic models, which may not have a great big mathematical superstructure. You may not need a Cray 2 supercomputer to run them, but actually, they work very well for restoration. And so it's these pragmatic models that I've been encouraging us to pay a little more attention to. Interestingly enough, it was an American, James, who developed the philosophy of pragmatism, which I'm told is the only indigenous philosophical discipline established in North America. And when I first became interested in pragmatism, I assumed that all Americans knew about this. I was living in Canada in the woods at the time. What can I say? You know, I thought people read this kind of thing. So most of what I've published on this is in European journals, because I thought it was the Europeans that needed to be enlightened about the power of pragmatism. And then I find out eventually, after a few years have gone by, that pragmatism really seems to be pretty much off the radar in North America. So I'd encourage students in here to maybe do a little bit of digging here, and maybe this is, in the long run, James's idea of how we bring pragmatism into ecology might be something very much an indigenous North American contribution to ecology. Anyway, that's where these models come in, that they don't have necessarily a large theoretical foundation. What they do is they describe real data that's been collected in the field. So I'm not going to go off on a big pragmatism tangent because of time constraints, but basically pragmatism, we start with our observations, with the data that we've collected and the simple relationships we can find in that data. And then we go from there towards the more difficult and refined questions. So it's starting with what we know. So what do we know about factors that control diversity? Well, a very obvious one, and this is for my wetland audience, but the very, because it shows an example from wetlands, but the bigger the area, the more species it will support. There is a nice rule that applies to almost every system you go to look at. So if you're trying to decide how big to make a natural area, it can always be bigger. And that's always, almost always better. So area is the first one, which is was kind of the idea behind the world's largest wetlands. We only have so much money to spend on wetlands, and at least one of our criteria might be, let's at least make sure that the big, globally important ones are protected. And so the surprise for me here is the biggest wetland is in the Soviet Union, or Russia, as it's now called. The West Siberian lowland is, in fact, the biggest in the world. The Amazon is the second biggest, and I hate to say it, but the Everglades don't even show up on the list. And that's not to mean that the Everglades aren't important, but in terms of a global scale and size, it's relatively small compared to these other globally important ones. The second model was developed to describe diversity patterns in British chalk grasslands. And this is Grimes' model. He calls it the humpback model. I don't find that a very appealing name, so I usually call it the biomass model or the intermediate biomass model. And Grimes' basic point is that if you plot on the vertical axis the number of species, now he actually says potential species, and that could open a door that we could spend 20 minutes on. We're not going to. Just imagine that's the number of species observed, and the horizontal axis is the biomass and the habitat. And on the left-hand side, biomass is very low because there's so many environmental constraints, like drought or flooding, depending upon where you are. On the right-hand end, biomass is very high, and you have only one or two canopy-forming species. Think cattails, or possibly ponderosa pine. And in between, in a certain corridor of biomass, is where most of the species are found. Now this divides those, this figure, it comes right out of his book, which is why I use it. It divides the species into different groups, but the main thing here is to notice that we have indeed this hump in the middle with very high plant diversity. And so you could say if we're trying to manage natural habitats, we might prefer to have this level of diversity than this one or this one. All things being considered. So the question would be, all right, this describes British chalk grassland pretty well. Is it useful anywhere else? So we've tried applying it in wetlands. So here we have some data collected from Great Lakes and northeastern North America. Each of those points is a plot where we inventoried all the species, and we then clipped it and measured above ground biomass. And although it's very much skewed to the left, you can nonetheless see here, to some extent, Grimes' humpback model, where their diversity goes up, it reaches a peak, and then from then on, as you increase biomass and production, plant diversity actually falls. So when a wetland becomes eutrophic, you shift from this side to that side and you start losing plant diversity. To put it into a national scale, we then took plants and picked out just those which were on our nationally rare list. and said, where do nationally rare plants fall along this biomass gradient? And so here we have at the bottom, there's the biomass gradient, number of nationally rare species, and there's almost a threshold right here at about 100 grams per quarter meter squared, 400 grams per meter squared. Above that biomass, no nationally rare species. So it seems the Grimes model applies rather well to wetlands. And of course, in wetlands at least, the dominant on the far right that tends to exclude other species is cattail. But of course, that species changes from one habitat to another. And since then, a lot of people have tried applying this model elsewhere and have found it works surprisingly well. Daniel, has anyone done this for understory plants in the ponderosa pine ecosystem? Okay. Maybe you could even share the reference after the talk. Always nice to have a local example. Or are you talking about your own data there in this case? Ah, better still. Okay. And you can experiment, you can set up experimental communities and move around the amount of biomass they have and find, sure enough, we can, by changing environmental factors, we can push communities back and forth along that hump. Third general model, if you like, that has general applicability is that in any system, most of the diversity is in relatively uncommon species. So I'm illustrating this with some data here from pine savannas, although the basic observation goes back almost 100 years to Danish grasslands. And to analyze, to collect this kind of data, you go out and you collect a large number of plots, and then you sort your species as to species that occurred in 90% of the plots, 80%, 70%, 60%, and so on, down to species that were found in less than 10% of your plots. And then you add up how many species you had. So at the top here, there are no species in those longleaf pine savannas that occurred in every plot, which in some communities people have called core species that occur over and over again with great regularity. And nearly half of the species occur in less than 10% of the plots. So this means that whenever you're going to go out and try to restore plant diversity, these may be, the ones on the right may be the easy ones to work with because we have a lot of them and they're frequent. And the ones on the left, which contain most of the diversity, we don't have very many samples of in any particular habitat. On the right there is understory in a longleaf pine savanna for you to compare with your ponderosa pine. And of course, I've cheated a little. This isn't a typical plot. This is one with lots of carnivorous plants. And you can see several species of carnivorous plants growing in those plots. So people have gone out to a whole variety of systems and done this and find that in general, when you present your data this way, it's always heavily shifted to the left. Most of the species are uncommon. Competition seems to be an overriding factor in many plant communities. And just the most recent example I gave you from Turtle Cove, we found that competition was important. In this case, the general principle I want to share with you is that if you look at all possible pairwise combinations of competitive ability, so you take every species and you grow it with every other species, you find that in most plant communities, there's a natural sort of dominance hierarchy, which I think the zoologists will understand perhaps better from intraspecific effects. Yeah. But I suppose when I think about it, that I'm talking to foresters, I don't have to justify dominance hierarchies. It's pretty much accepted. So I'm not going to take you through the experiments we've done in wetlands, except to say that we've tried taking communities and collecting enough individuals to grow them in all possible pairwise combinations. And what we almost invariably find is that you have, and we'll skip right past this for time reasons, you almost invariably have a species which is dominant over all the other species, and you have some subordinate species, so that it doesn't matter what you grow them with, they always lose. So I summarize it by saying that plant communities seem to be arranged a lot like the hierarchy on a British naval vessel. There's a boss, the captain or the admiral. In this case, this is from my children's book, and it's upside down. So the boss is at the bottom, and he's the dominant. And then you have an enormous number of subordinates. And so from what we can tell from all these pairwise competition experiments, this is not a bad way of thinking about a plant community. And so if we're interested in managing diversity, the issue is, how do we keep all those subordinates in the community when we know there's a few dominants that have the capacity to exclude them? So competitive hierarchies seem to be a good general principle that applies across many different systems. Moving along towards the end here, we can there's sort of an intermediate scale that we've missed, which is the landscape scale. Grimes' model, where we looked at one biomass gradient, is kind of limiting, because if we go out into, say, the habitats of Arizona that Daniel was driving me through yesterday, you've got lava flows, and you've got... help me, Daniel. What else have we got in basic habitat types out there? Limestone, basalt-topped mesas, right. Why should we assume that every one of those has the same type of intermediate biomass model relationship? So the centrifugal model tries to put those together. Again, using this one is labeled wetlands, but you can try substituting Arizona species from the uplands. What you need to do is think about the core as being the high biomass end. The core site is the one that's fertile, and in Arizona probably has lots of water, and there's a competitive dominant that seizes that. And in the case of wetlands, that's often typha. And then going out from that are those gradients, like we saw with the grime model, and the gradients are going out where there are more and more constraints on growth. So at the very end, at the periphery, which is shown in dotted there, at the outer circle, we have no biomass. So we can imagine in the landscape we have a whole series of grime-like humped back models that meet at one end in the core and radiate out to different constraints. And the more types of constraints you have in a landscape, the more of these gradients you're going to have. As well, with that type of model, the unusual species in a region tend to be out towards the edges of the axes, often in those low biomass, highly constrained sites. And many of us who are field naturalists, if we're going out to look for rare plants, we often go to look for an unusual stressed site where we'll find different species. So the centrifugal model then lets us put together a whole series of those grime-like models, recognizing that each line radiating out from the core represents some type of fundamental gradient that exists in the landscape. And probably the more bedrock types you have, the more elevation gradients you have, where you have south and north exposures, probably the more centrifugal type models are useful in putting the entire landscape together. All right, the last two we're going to go over very quickly. That intermediate disturbance is important, and my examples all have to do with intermediate disturbance in fluctuating water levels on lakes. So if you have too much disturbance, it
basically eliminates the species that grew there.
If you have too little disturbance, those competitive dominants come in and exclude everything. And so over much of the geographical range of wetlands, the challenge is to get some sort of intermediate disturbance regime, usually through fluctuating water levels. Now, of course, if I'd wanted to tailor this talk just to you and not to talk about other habitats, we'd have put fire in here. And we can think about intermediate fire frequencies as being what, as I understand it, you're struggling to recreate in this landscape. If they're very low frequency, high intensity, you get these crown fires, which are not useful for maintaining biodiversity. But if you go to the other extreme with no fire, that has its own costs. So what is the appropriate intermediate disturbance range? And this seems to be a principle that applies across all those different ecoregions. Although the particular factor, whether it's fire or fluctuation in water levels, may change. Lastly, and I'll just mention that one of the factors that shows up increasingly as an important factor in wetlands is distance from road. We've done a lot of sampling where we measure all kinds of different factors in wetlands, and we also then measure some landscape features around them. And the two key factors that come out for controlling plant diversity in wetlands are forest cover and distance to road. So I think if I was starting something up like this in Arizona, I'd be very interested to see if distance to road is important in predicting certain properties of Arizona systems, such as perhaps number of invasive species. Two last slides to wrap this up. If we don't do a good job, if we screw it up, we're going to lose a lot of species. So what we're trying to do, you know, we need to take very seriously and do the very best job we can. And of course, coming from Louisiana, I usually show the passenger pigeon, the Carolina parakeet, and the ivory-billed woodpecker, all of which are extinct, with the possible exception of the ivory bill, which may or may not be a question mark. But the principle remains that if we don't do it right, we're going to lose more species. And in the end, I think of us as biologists being like that thin red line of the British Empire. It's up to us to use our own lives to be as effective as we can in protecting the nation's landscapes and forests. And so here we have the Sutherland Highlanders at the Battle of Balaclava, and their commander says to them, "There is no retreat from here, men. You must die where you stand." And their reply was, "Aye, aye, Sir Colin, if needs be, we'll do that." Well, that might be a good place for us to stop. And so I'm going to. But I'd be glad to take some questions.